Hello, everyone. I'm Trent Luce. Welcome to another edition of Rural Routes, the program where we gather every day at this time. Well, we do it Monday through Friday anyway. And what we do when we gather is continue to address the issues between food production and food consumption. It's Thursday, Susan Bradford. Are you up for another week here to delve into the past, how it plays a role in the future?
Oh, absolutely.
I thought for a minute you were going to say, nope, sorry, Trent, we did all we need to do. See you later. Bye. Thanks for having me. Susan Bradford joining us. She is an investigative journalist and brought us a tremendous amount of research on why people act the way they do last week. Hey, I wanted to ask you about China because you mentioned the world dominance of China last week. But before we get to that, I think I have to ask you about Jacob Rothschild and his passing within the last week. It seems like that has stirred the elites up just a little bit.
It does. And to me, his passing symbolizes the fall of Rothschild, because the elites at that level have so many medical support systems at their fingertips. And I think he could have lived well on into his 90s and beyond. And even if he were to have passed, as he apparently did, they could have had an actor fill his role. And Jacob Rothschild was until his passing, the power behind Vladimir Putin. So I found it very, I think it's going to be a very important and symbolic moment. And I hope that this is the beginning of the end, like to a transition into better times. And I certainly, I don't celebrate the passing of any individual, but I think he was a very wicked individual. And he was the patriarch of that family. So I think, in a way, his passing could be a harbinger of more positive times ahead.
Susan, I never thought about it, but you put it into context so well. I do believe, and there's a lot of people that might got a wonky eye when you said that, but I do believe they have actors / doubles, whatever you want to make it out to be, that do not allow people to pass until there's a specific time for that to happen. As much as I believe that, do we know that that's the case?
That has been the case, I think, at least since the past world wars. Most of the actors, if not all, at the elite level, we're talking about political actors in Hollywood, they are assets of intelligence, and they are advancing in an agenda. So they are a lot of money and time and marketing is invested in these individuals to advance an agenda. So even if that person were to die, or they were to decide that they no longer wanted to be part of it, there would be another asset who would then come in to replace them. And they would then, serve the role of the brand of whoever that person happens to be. There were, since the end of the World War, the Second World War, there had been reports, and I can give you a source for this too, that the Nazis had cloning technologies. And with the cloning technology, they're able to create a biological duplicate of an individual at the date of their, of whenever they were cloned, and then to implant a computer chip, like which is a 3D holograph of their brain, into that clone that would enable like a facsimile of that person to continue on. And one source for that is Dr. Beter. You can look up as BETR, his audio records. And Dr. Beter was the Export-Import Council he was the counsel to the Export-Import Bank for John F. Kennedy. So he has written extensively on this. He's also done a number of audio books that describe the process, and that it has been done since World War II, and that a number of very prominent players have had multiple actors and clones and doubles playing their role.
I try to be somewhat of a student of this, but yet I struggle in getting my mind around Operation Paperclip and all of the things that did not die at the end of World War II, but just scattered around the world to infiltrate.
That's correct. Once the Rothschilds acquired control of the British monarchy following the Napoleonic Wars, They advanced both communism and fascism, and these were kind of different sides of the same coin to foment war, to reorganize society under their control. Like they would establish political control and commercial control. So the Nazis were also one of their phenomena. And after World War II, they established a think tank in Madrid, which was geared towards establishing the United States as the Fourth Reich. And among the creators of this were Henry Kissinger, Klaus Schwab was connected to this, the head of the World Economic Forum, as was George H.W. Bush. So the agenda has continued, since the world wars.
And to your point, Kissinger and Jacob Rothschild both passed in very recent days. And meanwhile, half of the British royal family are AWOL.
That's true. I think Kate has disappeared, and King Charles has apparently developed cancer, and he's disappeared. So I think change is afoot, and I hope it isn't the type of change where they are doing away with all of the old guard and are bringing in a new global system, with the more controversial characters out of the picture. But I hope this does symbolize or signify a positive change that is underfoot, at the global level.
I find that whole part of it very interesting, Susan. But I want to go back to where I mentioned I thought we'd start today, and that is China. Not only do they have 1.5 billion people, they continue to be a global power. When did that begin?
That really began, and I'm not going to go too heavily into the deep history, but it really began during the Venetians' dominance of the maritime trade. Like they were the ones who established the inroads for markets into China. They realized that this was a vast territory with many people who did not have many material products. And essentially proved to be an unlimited market for them. So China for centuries has been viewed as the great game, among the European aristocracies where incredible fortunes were to be found. But the agenda was launched at the end of World War II at the Yalta Conference. And this is where Prime Minister Winston Churchill, Soviet Premier Joseph Stalin, and President Franklin Delano Roosevelt convened. Each one of them was controlled from the shadows by the Rothschild dynasty. And among the agreements, which were very treasonous for us, was that they were going to elevate communist China to leader of the New World Order and then relegate the United States, as it is becoming now, to a bankrupt welfare state. So it does go back that far.
I actually have a friend, very dear friend, who spent a lot of years in China, ultimately came home because he got tired of certain individuals within Chinese leadership telling him that his grandkids would speak Mandarin in the United States.
This was an agenda that was planned, and it very unfortunately, it was planned with the complicity of our own government and our own people. The communist Chinese Revolution, which enabled Rothschild to essentially establish control over the Chinese market, was facilitated by Yale University through their Divinity School, and they established Yale in China. They tapped Mao Zedong, who was allegedly, this is according to royal historians, they tapped Mao Zedong, as a Mao Satan, Mao Zedong, to lead the communist revolution. They groomed him in Marxist ideology. They sponsored his schools, and they provided him support to wage a communist revolution that killed some like 20 to 30 million, I believe, Chinese citizens. So they were instrumental in essentially seizing control of the Chinese government. And so from that point onward, our elites had planned to stake out communist China for corporate America and Wall Street.
I think that
So
Mao
they
Zedong actually committed, if you count the famine, the starvation, I think his death toll was top of 60 million.
it's possible.
And You brought up that conference, and I will never get out of my mind, Susan, the image of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, Winston Churchill, and Joseph Stalin sitting on a bench, laughing and having a good time, celebrating pretty much the demise of Hitler while Stalin was killing tens of millions of people in his own country at the same time. That to me is just a hypocrisy of the world as we have known it in recent times. Susan Bradford, my guest. We will take a break. We'll be back with more history and how it relates to today after this. Certified Piedmontese is a group of Great Plains cattlemen working together to generate a consistent supply of tender beef for you, the consumer. It's this simple. You can go get the information at the protein plethora, cpbeef.com, and then order. And the best deal here, you don't need to go to the store. We deliver the tender beef to your door. Details again, cpbeef.com, Certified Piedmontese. Welcome back. Roll Route, Trent Luce, investigative journalist. Susan Bradford joining us for the second week in a row on a Thursday. So before we go any farther, Susan, obviously people listening are like, we're doomed. We can't do anything about this. I won't accept that. I still believe that I and collectively we can take this back.
I agree. There are more of us than there are of them. There are only really a few individuals involved at the very top. And since the Rothschilds have wanted to establish themselves as that one preeminent family who controls everything, power is really consolidated within the hands of a very few. And it is principally, you know, the Rothschilds. They have established a secret breeding program where they have bred themselves into the governments and into the royal dynasties throughout the world. And they're controlling these governments through blackmail and bribery and other control methods. And I think a lot of governments and people around the world are waking up to this. And I think that if you begin to research how they've set this up, it has been done through color of law. I mean, there is fraud and deception and betrayal of trust, breach of contract, at every stage. So I think their position is illegitimate and it's unlawful and illegal. And so what they rely upon is our consent. And that's why they always need to acquire our consent. Like, okay, it might be illegal, but you agree to it. Therefore, we can do what we're going to do. So I think the key for us is to educate ourselves, to educate each other, and then to voice our opposition and resist where we can, you know, from whatever a sphere of life we happen to find ourselves. And I frankly, personally, I'm very optimistic, you know, and I think we can and will overcome, and we will, you know, take our countries back.
Well, in reference to how you closed our conversation last week, in the end, we win. We just try to minimize the carnage along the way. That's the moral of the story.
Right.
So yesterday on this very program, J.C. Cole from New Jersey said something that I was unfamiliar with, and maybe you can shed some light on it. But he said that someone had actually dug into the genealogy of all the presidents of the United States. And all except for Martin Van Buren, the seventh president, the first U.S.-born president, they all have a common DNA structure. Do you know anything about that? Which would indicate what you just said about the Rothschilds breeding program alive and well.
That is possible. I know that Bill Clinton, for example, is allegedly a Rothschild bloodline. He was the illegitimate son of Winston Churchill and Pamela Harriman, who was the wife of Admiral Harriman, who established the national security state with George H.W. Bush. Bill Clinton was one of the bloodlines. Hillary Clinton may also be a bloodline, I believe, from Adolf Hitler. Hitler was, in fact, a Rothschild bloodline. His grandmother was a servant in a Rothschild mansion, and they produced the child who then sired Adolf Hitler. So there are a lot of these bloodlines. The American Revolution, in part, was waged through the financial shenanigans of Rothschild. So it's very possible that from that point onward, that they were trying to insinuate themselves into the political structure. But I don't know all of the genealogies of at what point they then began to infiltrate our, you know, our presidency. I know that a lot of our leaders were very patriotic and did resist the agenda, but I'm not sure at which point they actually, you know, bred themselves into
Yeah.
our executive.
That's one area I'm going to go dig into myself because, well, this may seem strange, but I've been in the livestock business my entire life, and everything I do in livestock, being cattle, horses, and pigs, and even goats, is about genetics. And so it's always been my bailiwick. I never
Correct.
thought about the genetics of the people who lead this country and how similar they are. It's an amazing concept.
You're breeding for a certain, you know, a type of DNA and characteristics, you know, within livestock as well.
Yeah, absolutely. But most of those are for production and for eating qualities, which is a little different than we're doing for world domination through tyrant leaders. But I diverse. Okay, so you said something else that really intrigued me, and I'm absolutely flabbergasted that nobody else has reported on this. Nobody. I haven't seen anybody even talk about it, but I have a dear friend who's a retired U.S. Navy special ops. A little over 3 weeks ago, Susan, he got a hold of me and he said, well, let me back up. 6 months ago, he said, Trent, there will be a war in between China and Taiwan. It's going to happen. It's a matter of when. And I had him on this very program in October. He walked us through why it was going to take place. And most of it has to do with 66% of the world's goods that are exported go through that Taiwan Strait. That's a massive number.
It is.
And just 3 weeks ago, we sent three more aircraft carriers to the Taiwan region, which means we now have five. And he came back on my program and he said, Trump, this is unprecedented. The United States military has never had five aircraft carriers in one particular spot. War is coming between China and Taiwan. And it really has to do with two things: the semiconductors that Taiwan has a market on, and two, the ability to ship freight and trade goods around the world, and how important this little region of exporting products to the entire world is. Number one, nobody's talking about that. And then I got to thinking throughout the course of history, how much of the world domination has been about who can export and trade goods. And you just mentioned the history of China. When I went to Dublin, Ireland in 2012, I learned that everything I was taught in high school or in grade school, whenever I learned about the potato famine, was a lie. There was a blight on the potatoes, but 1 million Irish died of starvation because the crown continued to export food to other countries instead of feed their own people. And you know, the whole Indian Ocean scenario and the Indians controlled had world domination because of trading of goods. Is that what most of this is? Just a war over who's trading goods with who and who's controlling that?
Yes, it is. It is about establishing a global monopoly on trade and commerce. And to address the issue of the potato famine, Queen Victoria was a Rothschild. And I recall reading specifically that she blocked efforts to deliver foodstuffs to the Irish people. And I thought that was very interesting that this was another Rothschild orchestrated famine of over 1 million Irish died. And according to history, well, some historic records, the lost tribes of Israel have relocated to Ireland. So this is very possible that Rothschild was trying to genocide a people whose the history he wanted to claim for the dynasty. The Rothschilds were also behind the Holodomor, if I'm pronouncing it correctly, in Ukraine, where they also exterminated people by cutting off the food supply. So that is one of their tactics. And yes, it is all about establishing a global monopoly on trade.
Susan, how do we get to the point that one family, and I think the Rockefellers have a great deal to do with it too, but how do we get to the point where two families have such an influence in the world?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I think it started with the Rothschilds' control of the British monarchy, which had an extensive, you know, empire throughout the world. And once they controlled the monarchy, they began to stage wars throughout Europe, where they, because they had acquired so much wealth and they had control of the Jesuit intelligence networks and other secret societies throughout Europe, they were able to foment wars against other governments throughout Europe and the world, control the outcomes, the wars, you know, since they had extensive intelligence networks, they were able to determine which businesses to bomb would be the competition, which to protect, which would be themselves. They systematically genocided world leaders, Christian aristocrats, and then stole the wealth. In fact, what was really kind of shocking to me is that a lot of the wealth or the treasures that are sold through auction at Christie's, for example, were those of genocided European aristocrats. Like they killed these people in cold blood and stole their assets. Through war, the Rothschilds were able to place countries into debt, and of course, with through debt, you control the nation. Then we have the secret Rothschild breeding program. And then once they were able to infiltrate and overthrow the European Christian monarchies, they then established these republics that appeared to be on the surface to represent the will of the people and to be a more modern, you know, enlightened type of government. But with these republics, they were able to expand their control over society, get control of the purse, and then weaponize that government to ensure that their interests were served above others. And then, of course, if you have a government that then subsidizes education and universities and the institutions throughout society, with that influence and money becomes your own influence. And so Rothschild, in that way, was able to control one government, one country after another. And to speak to the Rockefellers were actually their agents here on American soil.
The only thing you left out there, Susan, which all made perfect sense to me, is the subsidization of food around the world. And once you subsidize the farmer, you control the farmer, which is exactly why we are where we are today. Second half, roll out just ahead. Nitric oxide is essential. I take a tablet every single morning, have for 18 and a half years, thanks to the advice of Dr. Nathan Bryan. Get full details about why at NO2U.com. Trent's your coupon code, NO2U.com. Welcome back. Roll Route, Trent Lewis, alongside Susan Bradford, joining us, investigative journalist. Susan, you know what we need to do before, because clearly you and I get into these big world, deep thought discussions, and we run out of time every segment. You have authored some books, and if what we're talking about is of interest to people, where do they go find the books, and what are they called?
Okay, thank you for saying that. So the book on I have one book on China that reveals systematically how our government was sold us, we the American people, out to communist China, and how Kissinger set up the New World Order. And that book is The Shadow Dragon. And my book's Royal Blood Lies speaks to how the Rothschilds set up these puppet regimes, and then Tartar Treachery takes the agenda back to communist China. And all of those books are available on Amazon and through my website, which is susanbradford.org.
Everything leads to China.
Why? It does.
Why?
Because the Vatican had originally staked out China for its markets, and the Vatican is controlled by these very powerful commercial interests, the Venetians, the Lombards, their families that are associated with the Black nobility. And I think that they viewed China as this vast market where incredible fortunes can be made. They had no products or services, or very limited services, and expected their corporations to make a phenomenal fortune. And they had also discovered that the Chinese held the principles and the tactics for world domination, including the track and trace strategies. We also have the Confucian, you know, Hegelian dialectics, the philosophy of contradictions. And there was something else too. I just slipped my mind. Oh, the going back to the divine right to rule. So the Christian monarchs believe that they held the divine right to rule through Jesus. Now, the Chinese held, well, if that's the case, Noah, we can predate our Chinese emperors to Noah. Noah predicted Jesus. So if Jesus held the divine right to rule, then our connection to Noah places us above Jesus, and therefore we have the right to rule over humanity. So it does all go back to religion and the foundations of religion.
It's almost humorous because we have places with first in time, first in right for water use. It's almost like they're claiming first in time, first in right for who's going to rule the world.
That's correct. And they also claim that since the Native Americans have Chinese ancestry or DNA, that they came over over to North America during the Ice Age, that they were the first Americans and that they therefore are entitled to our continent,
I'm not
the
sure a
first
lot of
ones.
people know what you just said to be true. I happen to have lived on the Rosebud Indian Reservation in South Dakota for 5 years, Susan. And during that period of time, I learned that the DNA of the American Indian is actually identical to an Asian.
And not many people know that. They do claim that the Native Americans are the first Asians on the North American continent, the first American, sons and daughters. So it's
You
through them.
just accidentally put something else in context for me, and that is that I doubt you know this, but since 2021, January 27th, 2021, I have been in 42 states speaking about one topic, and that is Executive Order 14008, which is what we affectionately call as 30 by 30. Now, that did not originate in the United States nor the White House. It originated in the United Nations and then perpetuated by the World Economic Forum and all of what's happening in the farming populations of Europe today and what the EU did this week in saying that we will still take 20% of your land complies with by 2030, 30% of the land in the world will not be in food production. It will be returned to its natural state. But what doesn't get spoken about, and I've tried to throw it in and people don't want to accept it, but I'm starting to see it happen like in places like Minnesota and places like Nevada, where the whole 30 by 30 concept is about taking land away from white Europeans and
Correct.
returning it to the Native American tribes. That's really what I see happening. And you would have just explained why that is taking place.
Correct. I don't know if you were aware of the Supreme Court ruling during the Trump administration, which awarded half of the state of Oklahoma back to Indian country.
I am.
You are. That was part of it. And I think we may have discussed last week, I'm not sure, but that Rockefeller established the federally recognized Indian tribes on behalf of the Rothschilds in order to stake a claim on all of the natural mineral rights. Like they picked out land that was rich in oil and minerals. And it was through the Native American tribes that they were going to project social democracy and ultimately communism into the United States and, in their own words, and individualistic white Americans. So I think within our white European culture, we have the notion of individual rights and freedoms, and these concepts are very threatening to them because they want us to be governed under a tyrannical system.
You see, I used to subscribe to the theory that because of the welfare system, which I'm still not a proponent of welfare in any way, shape, or form, or a subsidy in any way, shape, or form, because it leads to everything we talked about in the first half, which is control. But Susan, I used to think that we created the dependence of the American Indian on the federal government because we put them on reservations. We started giving them food. We gave them smallpox. That's a side point. But we give them EBT cards and we continue to give them things and creating this generation after generation dependence. And one day I sat down with a leader on the tribe, with the tribe, the Rosebud Sioux tribe, and I was telling him how horrible this was, what the government did. He said, "Well, Trent, part of that is true. The other part is that our culture dating back to the originals, and this isn't the Asian part, now I see that, is that if we do our part here on earth, God will provide for us." And what has happened is that our culture has shifted into God being the government instead of the creator.
Correct.
And
And
I
I
think
think
that's what you just said.
that's correct. And I think too that our government saw that they perceived the Indians as consumer of government-sponsored goods. So the more Indians they could bring into these reservations, and many do not have native heritage, the more consumers they could have for government contractors, for housing, for medical care, for any number of goods and services that they could provide. And in many instances, our government has transformed Indian tribes into government contractors. So they are working with the military industrial complex and are generating, hundreds of millions of dollars, not only through casinos, but through other government contracts that are enriching these private corporate classes while keeping the Native Americans in poverty and in a state of dependency. But I think now they view that the dollar has replaced, the appreciation of the creator and the natural environment, as the main focus for Native culture.
And you just went to the next place I was going to go, which is as we expand gaming in the United States, in what demographic did the government do this with the
It's
tribes? It
the
was
tribes.
tribal.
And they control the tribes. Tribes cannot be taxed at the federal level. And they cannot be audited, they cannot be sued unless they agree to be sued. And so you have this perfect structure with hundreds of casinos around the country, tribal owned, that many of which were taxpayer subsidized, that are generating an untold fortune for these shadow elites, and they're doing it through the back doors of the tribes.
Yeah, I say all of this, and I have dear friends in Nebraska with the Winnebago tribe and in South Dakota and Pine Ridge and North Dakota, dear friends who are part are tribal members. And I'm thinking of a couple in North Dakota right now where I've had this discussion. They're beginning to see the light that they're just being pawns in this big Ponzi scheme organized by the federal government.
And it's very telling that many of these Indians are in poverty, even though their tribes are generating, billions, in revenue. And a lot of that money was intended to be given to them, for in per capita payments, was intended for their support. And yet they're always trotted out as window dressing to demonstrate why the tribes need to be fed more billions of dollars, in contracts, to help them achieve a level of economic parity.
When I moved in Halloween 1998, and I should say we, Susan, because my wife and I moved to the reservation in 1998 on Halloween. And I was actually working with a family from North Dakota who we built a pig farm. And my job was to interview and teach tribal members to raise pigs. That's what I was doing. That's why I was there. And we brought our own cows along with us. But as I was doing job fairs and different types of things, they were bragging about this, the Rosebud Sioux tribe, because they had an 87% unemployment rate. And the bragging part of that was that Pine Ridge was at 91% unemployment. So as long as we're better than Pine Ridge, that's all that really matters. But anybody that would from the outside look at that and say 87%, 9 out of 10 people were unemployed. That's
It's
unimaginable.
worse than that. In with the Saginaw-Chippewa Indian tribe, I recalled reading news bulletins where they were bragging about the number of alcoholics and drug addicts, because with the increasing numbers, the government would then feed them more millions of dollars to buy holiday resorts where they can then relax to recover from their alcoholism. So I think the more weak and more dependent they are, the more money they get from the federal government for their care. So it is seen as a, like a feather in their hat.
With all of that said, I did a TV program from the Winnebago Reservation in Nebraska last fall, and Lance Morgan, who's got casinos, and he is taking the revenue from those casinos and creating better living conditions and creating more independence on that tribe than any I've seen anywhere in the country. So it's not 100% bad, but it takes a champion in each particular environment. And fortunately, the Winnebagos have that in Lance. We'll take a break. Susan Bradford, we've got one segment left on another Thursday broadcast. More after this. Simpson Farm Enterprises continues to bring equipment, spraying equipment, Apache sprayer technology, innovation, technology, as I mentioned, and service. Now, Simpsons are based throughout Kansas and Nebraska, but do business in all of the lower half of the Great Plains of America, including Colorado. High Plains Apache is working in the north, both of them working at providing you the tools you need to minimize the pest being weeds and insects, and maybe do a little fertilizer application along the way. Get more details about the Apache technology or find somebody who's got an Apache sprayer or has dealt with Simpson Farm Enterprises or High Plains Apache, and you'll see why I am a true believer in what these families do for you. Details at simpsonfarm.com or highplainsapache.com. The Sugar Beet International is coming in Grand Forks in 2 weeks, and I plan to be with High Plains Apache at that event. Look forward to seeing what I can learn about sugar beets and the future of weed control. Maybe we just need more weed control everywhere. Welcome back. Roll Route. Trent Luce alongside Susan Bradford. We pretty much covered the Native American. And by the way, when I was on the reservation, if you'd call an American Indian a Native American, they'd say, "We've been American Indians since day one. Don't try to be politically correct with me." It was everybody else who wanted to call them Native Americans. But anyway, you mentioned something before we started, and I've got a real angst with Microsoft, mainly because of Bill Gates. I think there are many people more dangerous than Bill Gates. He tends to be a puppet that we see so that we're always distracted. But from a standpoint of a free, fair election, from the standpoint of truly implementing we, the people, and the power that this document tells us that we are supposed to have as American citizens, as long as Microsoft and this Azure cloud is controlling the algorithms of the voting results, it's a little hard to see that we're going to fix this voting system. I think that Microsoft has worked its way into every aspect of our life and assisting in these elites and controlling our world. Where do you go from there?
Yeah, that's a very good and very important point, because Microsoft is one of the proxies through which the Rothschilds work. And we discussed earlier about how the end game is monopoly. Part of that began, you know, during World War II with Hitler. Hitler, you know, helped eliminate the competition and shored up business for those choice corporations. IBM was key to building up and investing in Hitler's regime. They became very profitable through the tabulation system that enabled them to track and trace the Jewish concentration camp victims. And for decades thereafter, our federal government was pursuing litigation against IBM for its anti-competitive monopolistic practices. And this went on for decades. They never settled. They continued to breach and betray their agreements with the government. And finally, I think this was during the Reagan administration, one of the judges, the judge who was on that case was replaced with a judge from Frankfurt. Frankfurt is the capital of the Rothschilds, so may very well have been, you know, a Rothschild asset. But he had determined that IBM had fulfilled its obligations and was no longer in breach of the law, because now there were competitors that were competing against IBM for that space. Well, those competitors were created by IBM, and Microsoft was one of them. Bill Gates' mother, you know, Bill Gates was the founder of Microsoft. His mother worked on a board with the head of IBM. IBM acquired one of Microsoft's systems, and then Microsoft was essentially handed the baton and then continued on that same quest for global dominance, engaging in the same practices over which IBM was prosecuted, the same anti-competitive monopolistic practices. And it gets even worse. During the first Bush administration, and you know, George H.W. Bush was a protege of Henry Kissinger, who worked on and was the head of the liaison office to China during the Nixon administration. He tapped Microsoft to become one of the first tech companies to enter the Chinese market. And Microsoft, in turn, has been advising the communist Chinese government with 5-year plans and the military on their technological development. So essentially, in my view, you know, that arrangement could be very treasonous and might account for why, you know, Microsoft is so vested in manipulating our elections to a certain outcome.
I wish everybody who cares about our future would go watch the depositions of Bill Gates that you can still find today on YouTube, and look at how that guy acts compared to who he thinks he is today. And you tell me, number one, either it's not the same guy, or number two, he's completely taken over and controlled by somebody, because those depositions of Bill Gates, and I think it was the 80s during Reagan administration, are remarkably repulsive.
He stole his, I think he stole his original operating system and was very kind of unscrupulous from the beginning. And I think another video that your audience may want to watch is the an interview with Charlie Rose and Sir James Goldsmith. And Sir James Goldsmith was a Rothschild who saw the light. And back in the 1990s, during the Clinton administration, when he was a member of European Parliament, he spoke to how the elite were trying to establish a global monopoly on farm production and food production. So that has been planned.
But that didn't happen.
I know, but they haven't achieved it yet.
they're far too close. And this is my world that I deal in every single day. And they're continuing to make accelerated progress right now, Susan, on how close you pay attention to this, by giving out subsidies like we've never seen. And my colleagues are just saying, hey, I got to take it because my neighbor isn't going to be at a disadvantage. You're going to all be controlled. We're going to all be controlled because you're taking this handout instead of doing what we need to do, take care of God's creation and improve mankind.
That's true. They're trying to run the small farmer out of business. And then who's moving in to buy the farmland? You know, Microsoft. And I think I read that they want to produce like lab-made food.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
absolutely.
Who knows what they'll be putting into that.
How deep into the food system have you dug into? What might you teach me about the food system?
I think you probably have more to teach me at this point. Okay. I know that generally they are moving into lab-created meat, like Beyond Meat. But it does not appear that a lot of Americans are buying into that. Like they're rejecting, you know, these alternative sources because they lack nutritional value. They're not as tasty. It's like a poor quality type of food that they're attempting to mass produce. But the specifics, I'm not too sure about.
It's been a complete bomb in the marketplace. They continue to pile zillions of dollars into alternatives to meat, milk, and eggs, actually. And the public does not want it. And they're trying to find a way to mandate it instead of allowing the free market to take care of it. I think it's been a complete shock to them because they wanted to create this whole notion that animals are contributing to climate change. Consequently, if you want to fix that, you buy our product that have no animal ingredients in it, except most of them actually go back to an origin of an animal. And people are rejecting them left and right, and our consumption of meat globally continues to increase annually, and that did not factor into their plans.
That's true. I think they were they're expecting to succeed that during the recent pandemic. I remember that they were just slaughtering, you know, many, many cows and cattle and pigs and doing away with the sources of meat. And they're also, I think they still are, trying to sneak insect parts into the food. So they're not telling you that they're there, but then gradually they're trying to acclimate us to different food products and trying to convey that, look, they have a good nutritional value and you've been eating them for years.
Yeah,
so it's,
absolutely.
That's a bad trend.
Almost 2 million pigs were euthanized for no good reason in 2021. It was a horrible year.
I saw that. That was... you know, the pigs are God's creation too, and I know they are a food source for people. But just to, you know, to kill them for no good reason, just for their own market share, you know, really to me it shows a really sick kind of a mental disposition.
It happened one other time in U.S. history. I'm curious if you know when that took place.
Are you talking about the extermination of the buffalo?
Well, no, that was for a different reason, but that happened as well. We were down to like 1,500 head of buffalo and many people, but one guy named Scotty Phillip from South Dakota actually said, I'm not going to let this happen. I'm going to revive this species. And he did a fantastic job. But post Dirty 30s, coming into the Great Depression, or coming into the World War II, I should say, things were tough. And so the government took it upon themselves to go kill livestock and tell farmers they had to bury their own livestock, which ultimately led us to World War II.
Were they trying to establish markets from Europe, or why would they do
this? I don't know why they did it other than to create a financial hardship so that everybody would support the war, because coming out of the war, everything changed and the demand and the country effect during World War II just flourished and everybody needed to create a demand. So by creating an economic hardship pre-1940, they got everybody in the position of saying, we got to do something in these Germans. And you know, the most amazing thing about World War II to me, Susan, is that I went to a Holocaust museum in Los Angeles a few years ago, and I'm looking at front page papers from 38, 39, 40. In the Los Angeles Times, they were talking about the number of people that Hitler was killing and the genocide they were bringing upon folks in Germany. It's like, it's not like we didn't know. We were just sitting here doing nothing. Meanwhile, the people in Germany are sitting there doing nothing. But at the same time, the government's creating an economic hardship for American citizens, which puts them into the frame of mind, we need to go take care of Hitler because nothing's going on good here anyway. And if that doesn't parallel exactly where we're at and these same people trying to lure us into World War III, I don't think people are paying attention.
And I think they're also trying to, you know, create a terrific a hardship on American people, raising taxes, raising insurance, homeowners insurance, and so forth, raising the cost of living, where it's becoming very difficult for the middle class to survive. And I think through that hardship, they hope that Americans will become sufficiently weak where they will be able to, you know, to railroad their agenda through. And I think that is one of their long-term strategies.
Susan, once again, we're on the final minute. Where do people get those books, and what should we take home from this week's educational vast knowledge of yesterday in the United States and the world?
I think that the one takeaway is that we must remain vigilant and to, you know, be aware and of course do your own homework, since the media does you know, provide, you know, somewhat slanted information, but to educate ourselves, to be vigilant and to know our own power, that we can and will overcome this, that the enemy has been identified and exposed and the people are waking up. And many of my books do document precisely how the takeover was done. So with that knowledge, my hope is that the audience will be empowered, you know, to do something and to conceive, you know, to come up with ideas that will enable them to do just that. And they can find my books and also connect to my Substack through SusanBradford.org.
And I think the best thing that we've said, either one of us in this entire broadcast, is we typically don't know our own power. We cower.
Correct.
Because we don't recognize that one person has always made a difference. Are you going to be the champion? Are you going to be that one person? Thank you, Susan. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you,
Talk to you next Thursday.
Pleasure. Thank you.
Both Susan and myself remind you that all roads do lead to a roll route. Certified Piedmontese, once again, you do not need to go to the store. We deliver the tender beef to your door. Want to control food? You control the critters that produce food, because what critters do is take care of God's earth and then give you an upcycled protein supply with nutrient-dense nutrition. That's how it works. Certified Piedmontese does it in the tender package. That's the best part of this, and it's coming all. Every bit of it comes from the Great Plains of America, processing all done in the Great Plains and distribution. You don't need to go to the store. We deliver the tender beef to your door. Once again, the protein plethora to be found at cpbeef.com.